There is a realm which lies between fantasy and reality, where literary characters continue to thrive. Alice follows the White Rabbit into ever more strange worlds. Poirot compares case notes with Miss Marple. Peter Pan adventures with the Lost Boys even now. And so on. Within the realm there is a mountain path which winds through a dark wood. Unwary travelers are rendered anxious upon hearing wolves howl from within the forest, together with the bizarre cries of even more fantastic creatures. At the end of the path stands a magnificent and imposing gray granite stone mansion. Its Gothic splendor is topped by towers and turrets which look out over any unsuspecting traveler. Over the entrance doorway letters are carved into the stone. Hall of Heroes. Within the library of the mansion, surrounded by the books detailing both their own and many others' exploits and adventures, sit two similar-looking men. High foreheads plus their neat demeanor imply considerable intelligence. Their quiet conversation gives away their cut-glass British accent to any listener. A third man enters, tall and rangy with his long hair tied back. His walking gait is almost silent, not unlike a stalking wild animal. He pauses to speak.
Mr. Blake and Mr. Holmes, I do hope we are not discussing some mutual strategy.
One of the seated men smiles, and replies.
The Earl? Good afternoon, sir. I see we have forsaken the loincloth for a suit. Too chilly.
Not formal enough,
replies the Earl. All three men turn their heads to the sound of heavy footsteps, approaching through the library entrance. The new visitor is imposingly tall, with a heavy athletic build. His skin is colored a deep bronze, and his eyes appear to sparkle even in the half-light of the somber room. The Earl speaks first.
Afternoon, Clark. The gang not with you, nor the lovely Patricia.
Croquet, I believe. Prior engagement.
Clark replies, his voice possessing a deep rich timbre. One of the seated duo speaks up.
Marvelous, and I would wager for the usual argument between Colonel Mayfair and Mr. Brooks. The presence of Ms. Patricia would have more than compensated. Sad that she can't attend.
Where's Lamont, or Kent, or whatever he's calling himself today? Haven't seen him yet.
Notes the bronze man as a loud tapping on the table abruptly fixes their attention. They all turn to see a hawk-faced figure, seated at the table impeccably attired, and who has seemingly appeared from nowhere. He fixes the group with an icy stare, one hand tapping a pack of cards on the table surface, whilst the other plays nervously with an oversized opal signet ring.
Merely my poker tactics, chaps. Now shall we begin?
Hello and welcome to ThinkWorks, the place where we do all the heavy lifting when it comes to thinking. And this week it's another Adventures in Comics, in case you didn't get that from the introduction we've just done featuring Taz and Sherlock Holmes, Doc Savage, The Shadow and Sexton Blake. And the subtitle to this episode is really The Greatest Heroes No One Remembers, The Age of Pulp. Now most people think superheroes began with Superman, Batman, or the Marvel movies, even worse. But almost every modern hero stands on the shoulders of characters that no one remembers anymore. So the areas we need to be looking at, today's blockbuster heroes didn't appear out of nowhere. They were inherited, they were refined and commercialized, and the real pioneers of all that were these pulp heroes. So Batman didn't invent the dark vigilante, the Shadow did. Superman didn't invent the science-powered ideal man, Doc Savage did. And even Conan, Flash Gordon, Captain Marvel owe their DNA to earlier storytelling traditions. So what are pulp heroes and why did everything else follow because they came first? And that's the discussion that Chris Dingsdale and I will be having coming right up. So get yourselves ready, get some popcorn, and get yourself seated comfortably, and we will begin. So, hi, Chris.
Darren, good afternoon again, once again.
Yeah, and yet another Adventures in Comics.
In comics, yeah. We could and do with a few. The world could do with a few more Adventures in Comics right now, I think.
And I think...
Just generally.
Yes, and I think...
People like them because already the four episodes we've already done, all four are in the top 10 ThinkWorks episodes, which that's I think good. Is amazing.
Oh, that's great. That's great. I mean, you do well with them. So I'll credit that to you. I'm sure people don't tune in to listen to my nonsense, but.
I don't know. I think they love the fact that we just chew the fat and talk in rubbish for half an hour.
Correct. I'm good at that. I always have been.
So the purpose of this episode is we wanted to talk about pulp, the history of pulp magazines, really, and the heroes that came out of that, the reasons why, and why they're so important, even though nobody remembers them.
Correct. Yeah, absolutely.
So, I think for our listeners, I think the first thing we need to do is actually define what we mean by pulp, the pulp magazines.
Okay. Yeah. So there was a, let's be clear now. I mean, there's certainly a story magazine era, which applies both sides of the Atlantic. But in terms of the US, there's certainly a pulp magazine era, which seems to run from 1896 to about 1955.
Yeah.
Well over half a century. So it went on much longer than perhaps people out there are anticipating. And the pulp magazine, the US version of a pulp magazine was very much a certain, so it was 128 pages generally. Poor quality paper, hence the title pulps.
Yeah.
The edges were generally untrimmed and they were of a certain sort of small size, which I have to confess, I haven't written down in my notes. I don't know if you've got it, but they're quite recognizable. And I believe they replaced what was called the dime novel format in the US.
Yeah.
But certainly in the first half of the 20th century, they were hugely popular. And, whilst what we'll get onto is what we would call the sort of hero pulps, or, you know, with a certain character title, there were the popular version of the pulp was based around genres. So you had some quite famous magazines like Argo, See Weird Tales, you know, Weird Tales, which had people like H.P. Lovecraft in and some of the other great writers of the day, Robert E. Howard. And then you got to things which are even more literary, I guess, if you like that sort of thing, like Black Mask, which I believe featured the work of Dash Hammett. I think the Maltese Falcon was first serialized in Black Mask. But you had pulps based around love stories, boxing stories, flying aces, horror stories, adventure stories, spicy stories, which were the, you know, slightly
spicy
more
tales.
Spicy tales. Obviously, a tender soul such as myself did, you know, never read any of those. I'm sure you haven't either. So that was really what you'd call the pulp era. And they are, well, you know, I suppose what we'd like to point out, they're very much a precursor of the American comics era, which we've been talking about in the previous editions of Adventures in Comics. But maybe we should just take a step back, because we're talking about pulp magazines, which were text. Obviously, they had some illustrations in them. But, you know, where did they collide with comics? What were the first comics? What's your understanding of that?
I think what started to happen is the illustrations that were being done for things like Doc Savage and The Shadow, and over in Britain with the Sherlock Holmes serialization.
The
illustrations started to become full page. They started to become more of them. It was almost like that graphic understanding that the editors had, that actually a good striking visual can really start to pull in a reader and keep them occupied, especially if they're flicking through on a newsstand.
And they certainly help to give the titles an identity, you know, all of a sudden, you know, you're reading something, you've got a visual identity, which, you know, becomes familiar to the readers. I mean, I suppose you could take this as far back as you liked to cave paintings.
Yeah.
You know, illustration presumably preceded writing and language.
Yeah.
Just briefly, the first comic book is generally recognized as, it's actually a translation of a French book, which was printed in the US. Yeah. And it was called The Adventures of Obadiah Oldbuck.
Oh, yes.
I have no idea what that is. that was in the 1890s, maybe even before then. The first US comic book's generally regarded as the Yellow Kid.
Yeah.
1897. And then you get to something like 1933, which is the Famous Funnies. But both the Yellow Kid and Famous Funnies were actually collected editions of newspaper strips.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to come on to next, because then you had the developing newspaper strips, like, and then you had even then risque type racy strips, like, was it Sally was one of the newspaper strips, and she was always, you know,
disrobed.
Well, she was always in a underwear when the villains would decide they were going to strike to try and kidnap her.
Oh, really? I mean, that always seems to me a bit more of a British thing. You get to the Jane newspaper strips of World War II and things like that. But the Brits weren't separate from this at all. So, just to cover the British side of things, because it does become a little bit important when we start to talk about the story magazines.
Yeah.
The first British comic strip was Ali Sloper, right. 1867. And it was this, I like this. It was printed in a rival to Punch magazine. And the rival to Punch magazine was called,
go on,
Judy.
Judy. I could have guessed that.
yeah. And it's a beautifully drawn strip by a guy called, a guy called Charles Henry Ross. What I like about this, and it shows the difference maybe between the psyches of both sides of the Atlantic, was Ali Sloper was a con man and a drunkard, but he was the star of the strip.
He was
the strip's hero.
We liked our lovable rogues over here, didn't we?
Yeah, we've always liked them, let's be honest. We've always liked them. And the first, so that was, crikey, 1867, and actually the first British comic book was something called Ali Sloper's Half Holiday, which was published in 1884.
Wow.
And it was called Half Holiday because the beneficial factory and mill owners would allow their workers home at midday on Saturday.
Oh, that's jolly kind of them.
It was, yeah. So magnanimous. You know, they're obviously a real philanthropist. Yeah, so they were allowed home at midday on Saturday, and that was called a half holiday. But, yeah. I mean, all those things that we just talked about, they're clearly not superheroes, which, you know, appeared later.
No. And I think, because I think what came first really was the idea of the adventure hero. So, definitely. And so we've talked, and while we're in Britain, we might as well talk about the British. Well, they're not versions of they weren't versions of the American pulp movement, but they were a movement that started a little bit before and finished a little bit after, but they were a completely different kind of vehicle, but their genre started to be the same. So yes, you have
similarly forgotten, as we've just said about some of the American characters, similarly forgotten. Yeah. So, I mean, I guess if you start with something, you know, the premium version, Sherlock Holmes, Strand Magazine, 1887. I don't think we need to really go on about Sherlock Holmes. Everybody knows who he is. Probably
you would think so, but I've got an interesting. Famous.
Go on.
I've got an interesting anecdote, which I'll introduce in a moment when we talk about the other detective. An adventurer.
All right. So, Sherlock Holmes was popular. And as we know, comic books, literature in general, tends to kind of eat itself and reproduce itself. So in 1893, along came a character called Sexton Blake.
Yes.
Sexton Blake was basically a version of Sherlock Holmes to begin with, although he did kind of change over the years. Nobody remembers Sexton Blake.
No, and yet he was the first one that became like, in Britain, I should say, became the first franchised hero. There was a formula that anyone could write a Sexton Blake story so long as they followed a certain formula.
That's right.
But here's the thing that's going to, you're going to go, what? So when I was doing research on this, bless them, our American cousins, if there's any Americans listening, hi. We're not really poking fun at you, but we are poking fun at some of the cultural restrictions that some of your writers seem to be, and they don't do the research. So when I was doing the research on Sexton Blake, I was in an American, it said, and I get this, so Sexton Blake is often referred to as the British Sherlock Holmes.
Wow, okay.
It's like, well, Sherlock Holmes is British.
Yeah, Sherlock Holmes is actually the British Sherlock Holmes. Sexton Blake is also the British Sexton Blake. But
That fried my brain. I thought, where? I mean, how? I mean, that's because I think of the Basil Rathbone,
of course,
movies, and the the radio serial that they did on Sherlock Holmes after the films as well. But that idea that Sherlock Holmes is American, what?
Well, I suppose the thing is Holmes has been done in so many formats, especially recently. You know, you had the Benedict Cumberbatch thing over here. You also had the Elementary thing with Johnny Lee Miller over in the US, but both which particularly successful. But, I mean, Sexton Blake, as a forgotten character, has some phenomenal statistics. Over 4,000 stories by 200 different authors, and nobody remembers him. And that's the period from 1893 right through to 1978. Firstly, I think in Union Jack magazine, and then he moved into his own magazine. And then I think through post-World War II era, there was a thing called Sexton Blake Library. But as you said, you know, done by a number of authors. For people who are interested in following this up, if you've got a Kindle, there's some fairly inexpensive collections on Kindle if you go searching. And I think Rebellion Publishing did about 5 books about 4 or 5 years ago. Referencing the different eras, and some of these are really good. The best era to me, and it kind of reflects what we're talking about with the pulps, is the interwar period between the First and the Second World War, where he took on various, I mean, the British version of the supervillains, which I think is fascinating. So you have people called Zenith the Albino.
Wow. Because back in those days, all albinos were evil.
Well, probably evil. I have no idea why. Which kind of brings me on to another point in a second. Somebody called Leon Kestrel, and let's save the best for last, Waldo the Wonder Man.
Oh, right.
Waldo the Wonder Man, yeah. Waldo sadly, you know, the name Waldo for supervillains never really took off, I have to say. I mean, I think they're as close as a version of the British pulp you're going to get. The point I was going to make was clearly these stories are of their time and they reflect the, you know, moral attitudes and social attitudes.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you don't like a bit of stereotyping, you know, probably best not to go near them. But I'm sure most people who are listening are intelligent enough and, you know, seasoned in life enough to recognize that as a fact. But those stories in particular are kind of worth seeking out. And if you can find the original Union Jack pages, again, like we were talking before, they are beautifully illustrated.
Yeah.
There's a degree of craftsmanship about them. The other thing which is great about Sexton Blake, and again, if you look hard enough, you'll find the collection. The Christmas stories are something else. They're a British Christmas tradition. Yeah, it's got everything from you know, ladies making Christmas dinner, and you know, Christmas and figgy pudding, you know, lashings of custard.
Always lashings.
Yeah, always lashings of custard. I love a lash of custard.
Yeah.
So. And they are, and interesting enough, I think that era is very reflective of the period that we're talking about, which is the pulp era in the US.
Yes. Yeah, because, I mean, and there was a slightly different tack in that the British hero strips, we'll call them hero strips, they weren't superheroes yet.
Yeah.
There was quite a lot of them that had a backdrop of empire and a backdrop of the elite and certain circles that they were moving in. Whereas in America, the pulp heroes tended to be more gritty, more down to earth, more hard-boiled detective, which led into
that may have been a reflection of the times. You know, the US was going through, you know, America, Prohibition, the Depression.
Yeah.
Britain had its own set of social standards, which probably hadn't changed that much, you know, for 125 years. I've just thought, actually, I mean, here's a story you probably wouldn't get in the US pulps. There's one Sexton Blake story where Sexton and his sidekick Tinker have to join the British football team.
Oh.
To meet out a problem. And I think, from memory, when I was looking this up, and again, I think you can find the story fairly easily. I think they're playing the US soccer team, the US football team in the game. I think that's the climax of the actual tale. There's a story you wouldn't find in DC or Marvel for sure.
No, because I mean this is a quick aside, but I mean I've read particularly Marvel for some reason, but I read quite a few comics, DC comics and Marvel comics from the 70s, but Marvel continued this into the 80s. The stereotyping of the British kind of almost like our heroes were kind of locked in into the All Empire thing, and therefore were to be treated with suspicion. I mean, Contest of Heroes, for example, I can't remember that came out, it was the early 80s.
It was the 80s, mid-80s. I think, wasn't it? Yeah.
That had literally Irish Republic politics in it.
Wow.
Where okay. Captain Britain was very much seen as someone enforcing oppression.
Okay,
And it's that kind of strand of stuff still went through quite a lot, I think, of the magazines and stories that were published from the 1900s through to modern day, well, through to the 80s at least. But it's weird how that kind of strand of the British were not to be treated with respect because they were hoity-toity, or they were up to no good, or they were the greedy villain.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that the very thought that in the 80s, you know, there's a perception that Britain was kind of an imperial power or even had an empire anymore. But so,
I know.
But I guess old memories die hard in that respect.
They do. So let's go back to this American explosion of pulp then, because I think what really locked the pulps into these adventure stories where the detectives or the sword and sorcery adventurers or the Western cowboys, it was almost like America didn't want to think. It wanted action, and it wanted heroes that were doers, not thinkers.
I'd recast that slightly. I think you've got a point, but I think if we look at the two archetypes, which we're going to do, I think those are a response to the times. I don't think they didn't want to think. I think they wanted a response to what was happening, in society at that particular time.
Yeah.
I may be right. I may be wrong. I think there's something in that. All I would say is, if you're looking into the pulp area, if anybody wants to follow this up, there's a huge amount of very, very scholarly research been done by a small number of authors. I mean, you can do a deep dive into this as far as you wish to go, and it's a real minutiae. Yeah.
It is a real rabbit hole.
Yeah. And it's an important, whether it might be forgotten, but I think it's a hugely important era in fiction, which the fruits of which are probably only just coming in terms of commercial success to the fore now, in terms of movies, etc.
Yeah, and I think just to cast the pulp movement, as if we want to call it a particular period, but that pulp era, imagine if Netflix were around back then, that would be what they were doing.
It was correct, yeah.
Producing, yeah. Mass producing 500,000 copies of a single issue.
Yeah, yeah.
And getting it out there to as many people as cheaply as possible.
And as frequently as possible
as frequently as possible.
Which seems staggering, really. Well, I mean, shall we start with... we've got the two archetypes, really, and we've got two characters that represent those two archetypes. If we start with the Shadow...
Yes.
I mean, I guess whether people who are listening have or they haven't heard of the Shadow, I guess they may well have done peripherally. But the Shadow itself has got a hugely interesting origin. The Shadow almost created itself, which I think is fascinating. So the Shadow magazine came, and it's Street and Smith, who I think were the biggest publisher of pulp magazines. I think they were considered to be the sort of the prestige outfit in terms of output and probably page rates as well. I think, writers would pitch stories to them before anybody else.
Yeah, something else we need to mention as well. The writers were paid by the word.
Yeah.
So that's why, so they literally had to write as many stories as they could
and
get them published each month to live. So
yes, yeah. Although some of them did very well out of it. The top ones did very well out of it, as we'll see in a second. But so the shadow character in the Shadow magazine grew out of another magazine called Detective Story magazine.
Yeah.
And what was done to promote Detective Story magazine was that it had its own radio show.
Yes.
And the scripts they used were from stories in the current issues, but not that they featured the Shadow, but they were introduced by a mysterious character.
Yes.
I think espouse the famous line right from the beginning, you know, who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men? The shadow knows. Cue haunting laughter, which without alcohol, I suspect neither you or me can do.
No.
And that became so popular that people used to go to the newsstands and ask, could they have a copy of the Shadow magazine? Now, as you know, as a good publisher and as their business manager, a guy called Henry W. Ralston, never to pass up a chance, saw the chance to revive what they would call the single character magazine, which I think hadn't seen its heyday since the turn of the century with characters like Nick Carter, I think, which is not a familiar, you know, character to the British audience anyway. So they commissioned a magazine, and maybe this was done to protect copyright, who knows? They commissioned a magazine called the Shadow Magazine. They engaged a professional magician and also a writer called Walter Gibson.
Yeah.
To write it. The house name under which the Shadow was written was Maxwell Grant. And again, eventually several authors would do the stories. They didn't put a lot of faith in the first issue, apparently, even to the point of they'd actually reprinted cover art from a different magazine from years before. So the first magazine did not feature the Shadow.
On the cover.
It featured a shadow of somebody, but not the Shadow. So technically, we're good. And it was phenomenally successful. Believe it or not, it ran from 1931 to 1949, 325 issues. At one point, it was bi-weekly.
Wow.
So there were two issues a month. Gibson wrote most of them. He was phenomenally quick, obviously. Apparently, at its zenith, he would write on several typewriters.
Yeah.
Because the typewriters, I think, would literally get fatigued and wouldn't work. And he used to put sticking plasters on his fingertip because they used to wear out and bleed.
Wow.
Interesting. In fact, it was so famous that I think the typewriter company ran an advert in the trade press saying that their typewriters were the ones that the Shadow novels were actually written on, and that
fantastic
Walter Gibbs or Maxwell Grant, I guess, had written so many million words on a single, and I can't remember the name of the typewriter. I should have looked it up. Again, there is a ton of scholarly research on this. If anybody's heard of an author called Will Murray's not only an author, but he really is a custodian of this stuff. And there's a three volume set which you can find either electronically or published, where he goes through the whole history of the Shadow magazine, including interviews with Gibson, etc., etc. Gibson was quite a character. He was a musician. He was a magician. He also wrote several tomes on, you know, the practice of magic and illusion.
Yes.
So he was a bit of a character. I mean, I think he did very well out of it. It was, you know, this magazine, I think, was the most popular at the time. So
it was. And I think for readers, you see, we're in comic mode already. For listeners that aren't really familiar with what the Shadow was and what he brought and why he's important, it's because the Shadow really introduced the whole idea of the urban vigilante, the masked hero. He used psychological warfare. He broke the criminals down because he was always in the shadows, taunting. Yeah, yeah. And
that's right. And he used sort of, not only was he a violent sort of vigilante, he also used sort of psychological warfare.
Yeah.
It was gradually revealed that, you know, he'd gathered some of his abilities by spending time in the, you know, with the mystics in the Far East, learning how to hypnotize people.
And change his appearance.
His actual alter ego was always kept a little bit in the dark, as it were. People assumed he was Lamont Cranston, but then it was revealed he may not have been Lamont Cranston. He just borrowed his identity, and he was actually an aviator from World War One called Kent Allard. If you look at the visual image of the Shadow, he's got the slouch hat, the scarf, the long cape, etc. He's to say he's an urban vigilante. He has various associates who help him.
Yes,
we won't go into those, but he's clearly a forerunner of Batman.
Yeah, I think was it Bob Kane even admitted that Batman was inspired by him reading a shadow story.
Yeah, yeah. I think the first issue of Detective Comics, I think the story is pretty obviously culled from a story in the Shadow magazine.
Yeah.
I don't know if lawyers were ever instructed. The other thing we should say about it, the Shadow started in radio. We went to a magazine. It then went back to radio, where it was a hugely popular program because it. But the character was very different from the one that was in the pulps. You know, most famously played for a short period of time by Orson Welles. But he was almost the perfect character for radio because he was invisible.
Indeed. And I actually play those episodes on one of my radio shows, which is called The Wednesday Supplement. And we have a part in there that plays classic radio dramas. And The Shadow is one of the popular ones. We've also got a couple of Avenger ones, which we'll talk about in a bit. I've even got a couple of Doc Savage episodes.
Yes, yeah.
And whatever you wish we'll come on to. But the people, listeners to the Wednesday Supplement, they love it. They love The Shadow with Orson Welles. They think it's great. And
it's good, yeah. I was always disappointed when I first managed to get my hands on a radio show because I thought, who's this? This isn't the guy. And now I read them about him first in the comics, in the DC comic series from like 74 onwards. But I thought, this is not the same character. But it's clearly got its own appeal. And then you think, oh, yeah, well, he's an ideal character for radio. He's invisible.
Yeah.
You don't need to see him, you know. No. Which is, you know, genius in itself. And Welles is great in it, as are most of the others. And there's some great stories. Again, you can find them pretty easily online. I think they're all in the public domain, aren't they now?
Yeah, there's I think it's called Old Time Radio. I think that's the main one. They have some great shows on there. Absolutely brilliant. And some of the episodes you need to kind of put through Audacity and clean up a bit. But they're pretty good, really.
As we were mentioning before, you know, if you know the Shadow was what the popular audience needed at the time, my view of that was he a response to sort of gangsters and prohibition that was probably dominating US, you know, headlines in that part of the world at the time, violent crime, etc.
And corruption.
All of a sudden, we were providing with a guy. Okay, his methods might be a little suspect, but you know, his motivation's always correct, and he wants to bring these people down by whatever means possible. And I guess, you know, people would lock, you know, popular opinion would lock onto that. Plus, that, you know, they're very well written. They're written in a real, I find them to be written in a real shorthand.
Yeah.
Which kind of adds to the visceral nature, but certainly worth seeking out. And a lot of these things were reprinted fairly recently. I think Sanctum Press reprinted every Shadow novel, but they've variously been reprinted in short bursts all the way since they stopped publication. There's some really nice ones in the 70s with covers by Jim Steranko.
Wow.
And I think if you know, a lot of the classic comic artists, that you know, they're huge fans of the character and just the look and the style of it.
Yeah, because, you know. The visual identity of the Shadow just...
Yeah, terrific. Yeah, it's terrific. Yeah. And when you see the visual identity, you know, you can see where Batman came from. You know?
Yeah.
So that's one archetype, which is the mysterious mass vigilante who's going to dispense justice from in the shadows.
Yes.
And so he's a precursor for Batman. So who's next then?
I think probably old Doc himself, Doc Savage. I think we need to look at him.
Yeah, he's a huge favourite character of mine. And Doc Savage came about because the Shadow was so popular.
Yeah.
But the Shadow's, you know, ethics are based in mystery and mysticism, etc., etc. But let's not give a good thing up.
No.
Henry Ralston, our guy again, and editor John Nanovich at Street & Smith decided to come up with a character who would be based in science rather than mysticism.
Yes.
And they based him on so they came up with the concept of Doc Savage, apparently based on a guy called Richard Henry Savage, who at the time was a noted 19th century adventurer who would have been written about in journals, newspapers. And I think they asked a guy called Lester Dent. Now, Lester Dent was a former telegraph operator.
As you are.
As you are, but he was submitting stories to the pulps and he dreamt of being a writer. Apparently, he always dreamt of being a writer for the, you know, the really classic magazines like the There's a famous New York Daily Post and all the
the
adult magazines, as it were. But anyway, he was he eventually landed the job of writing the Doc Savage novels under the pen name Kenneth Robeson. Now, Lester Dent, Walter Gibson was a magician. I think this is interesting. Walter Gibson was a magician. He was interested in, you know, in illusion, et cetera, et cetera. Lester Dent was also the real deal. He was an adventurer.
Yeah.
So he went prospecting for gold. The Doc Savage novels did extremely well for him. He had a yacht. He searched for sunken treasure.
Yeah.
Amongst the Caribbean islands. So, you know, in some ways, the characters, interestingly enough, but reflected their personalities. And whether they were chosen for that or not, I really don't know. I got to say, I love the Doc Savage. I love the character. Yeah. I love the novels, of which there were 181 initially.
Wow.
Between 1933 to 1949. Again, there were several other writers under the house name of Kenneth Robeson. But I think, if I'm right, so I think most of the stuff, even when they were ghostwritten, I think a lot of them came under the attention of Lester Dent, who used to rewrite patches of them to make sure they all fitted in.
Yeah, because he also created, again, like Gibson, he created a template.
Correct,
a formula that the stories had to follow, and followed that franchisee-type approach to the heroes.
And the other thing with Doc, of course, I mean, his appeal spread beyond, you know, the initial run. In the 60s, Bantam Books decided to reprint, or to try reprinting them, which they did with The Man of Bronze, which is the first book. But the genius they brought to it, they engaged the artist James Barmer.
Yeah.
To create a cover which has that definitive Doc Savage image of the muscular guy with the ripped shirt, the jodhpurs, the belt buckle, although he did change his hairstyle at least once.
Yes.
And the guy who actually posed for the pictures for Jim Barmer and other artists since then as well was a guy who's now passed away called Steve Holland, who was an actor, oblique model, oblique bodybuilder, who really defined that classic look for Doc. And whilst that image isn't always prevalent in the novels, it certainly doesn't clash with what's in the novels.
No.
But those images are so striking, it just makes you want to, you know, read the story.
Yeah.
Interesting enough, the most popular book was Brand of the Werewolf, which I think had a Mort Kunstler painted cover of Doc fighting a werewolf. Now, no werewolves are harmed in the reading of that book because there ain't one in it.
No.
Other than on the cover. So they reprinted every story, actually. And then Will Murray, who became the literary agent for Dent's estate once Lester Dent passed away, working with his widow, uncovered another novel that had never been printed called Red Spider.
Yeah.
I mean, the good thing about Doc is that he kind of changed over the years. So he was very sort of very... I mean, he was never superhuman, never had superpowers, but he was pretty omnipotent. But as the years went on and as taste changed, the Second World War came along and then the post-war era, they kind of toned it down a bit. And by the time of Red Spider, he was almost an operative for sort of, you know, US Secret Service. Good great novel, by the way. And then beyond that, Will Murray then started a series of novels. Which was latterly called The Wild Adventure of Doc Savage, but he started it. The first ones were printed in the 90s.
Yeah.
Python Isle. If anybody wants to get into Doc Savage and doesn't fancy reading the old books, I could heartily recommend the Will Murray novels.
Yeah.
They're still written under the house name of Kenneth Robeson, but
if
you Google Wild Adventures of Doc Savage, you'll see all of them. But they're absolutely terrific. Again, I suppose we should maybe say The Shadow and Doc Savage, you know, they're products of their time, so there's a little bit of stereotyping going on. In the modern novels, I mean, there's some, you know, questionable stuff there, how Doc deals with the criminal element once he's caught them.
Yes.
His rehabilitation technique.
Yes.
I mean, Will Murray doesn't ignore that. He kind of goes with it, but they are terrific. And also, in terms of the character we were talking about before, there are two crossover novels in the last batch.
Right.
Which are terrific.
Yeah.
And are almost couched. One is a shadow story with Doc in it.
Yeah.
The other one is a Doc story with the shadow in it. So
there
is difference, chalk and excellent. But they're really good, really well worth seeking out. I'm a huge Doc Savage fan.
Yeah, I mean, my introduction to him came in the Marvel Black and White magazine range in the 70s. Yeah. And they only did 8 issues. But those 8 issues were just incredible visualizations of some of the key stories.
Yes, yeah. Oh, from, terrific. They are terrific, yeah, by Doug Moench and Buscema, Tony Dizaniga. There's a great issue, which is half it's penciled by Marie Severin, which I think is set in Casablanca.
Yeah.
And just the period imagery and the atmosphere are terrific, really. Yeah. Interesting enough, I think the Shadow's always been more successful in the comics rather than Doc. I think a lot of publishers have struggled with Doc. I think their interpretations of Doc are always interesting.
Yeah.
But I don't think they were as successful as
No, sadly, I think the movie that came out in the 70s as well.
1975. Kind of,
yeah.
Ron Ely.
Yeah. It could have been so good.
Ron was great. Ron really was great. I mean, I can't imagine anybody else being able to play Doc Savage at that point in time. And he's really good. But
that's what I mean. It could have been really good.
Yeah. But... I mean, it was the first time in my life I was disappointed in a film. Yeah. I was really looking forward to seeing it because that's how I found Doc Savage by reading. I discovered the Corgi paperback of The Man of Bronze, which said it was a movie tie-in. So I couldn't wait to see this film. Oh, dear. Never mind. It is what it is. It's all nostalgia. And I still rewatch it every now and again.
Yeah. But that aside, and the fact that Doc himself hasn't been a huge success in the comics medium, we need to now say why he is so important to the comics medium.
Let's start with Doc's name. His name is Dr. Clark Savage Jr.
Okay. Yes.
Let's remember that. Remember that first name?
Yeah. He's often referred to as a Superman.
He is often referred to as a Superman, correct. That's absolutely right. And he's based out of New York on the 86th floor, what is probably the Empire State Building, although it's never specifically noted. Actually, the first time I went to New York, I actually went in the foyer of the Empire State Building to see what was on the 86th floor. He's not there.
Oh, damn.
But his other headquarters was actually located in the Arctic, and it was called...
The Fortress of...
Solitude.
Indeed.
Now, where have we heard that again? So...
Let me think. and later on, he also got referred to as the Man of Bronze.
Yeah, that's true.
Man of Steel.
We got the Man of Steel. I think in terms of superhero, there's so many tropes that originated with Doc. The team element, the bickering team members.
Yeah, Fantastic Four, definitely based on his...
Yeah,
his,
challenges of the unknown.
Yeah.
There's so many direct correlations. But, I think that character gave so much of the superhero comics that followed in terms of convention, etc. And again, as far as we know, lawyers would... have never been instructed. I don't know. I don't know that. No. As far as I'm aware, there's no overriding court case where they argue.
No, I think people were a little bit more laid back about IP back then as well.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think it's only when the big studios started to get involved that it suddenly became...
Yeah, yeah. But remember, there was the case back in back in the day where National Periodicals, who became DC Comics, pursued a case against... the original Captain Marvel.
Yeah.
Saying he was obviously taken from Superman.
Yeah.
But Street and Smith clearly didn't pursue National Periodical publications for all the elements they stole from Doc Savage, to formulate Superman. And I think Siegel and Shuster were self-admitted Doc Savage fans.
Yeah, yeah. And just as an aside to the DC pursuing Silver, Captain Marvel was... based on Superman, so they had to call him Shazam. The irony, of course, is then that Marvel Comics sued DC Comics over the name Captain Marvel.
Correct, yeah, yeah. Poor old
There's like a 50-year gap between the characters.
Poor old Captain Marvel. He can't catch a break, can he?
Bless him.
Now, as we were saying before, the Shadow character, the reason its popularity is part, at least in part, it's a response to the times.
Yeah,
I just wonder really with Doc, in theory, has no superpowers. He has an awful lot of resources and he can call upon his five companions, all of which have their own speciality. But essentially, Doc's a self-made man. He gets up in the morning, he does a two-hour regime, which involves physical exercise, you know, mental gymnastics, call it what you will. And you just wonder that it was the Depression era, you know, people maybe wanted to read about a guy who basically has elevated himself. He's not relied on anybody else. The state's not going to do it for him. You know, a company's not going to do it for him. So maybe it's that whole thing of self-improvement that was, you know, that was appealing, as well as all the adventure elements.
Yeah, I mean, although, as you say, he didn't have superpowers per se, but he was a polymath genius at just everything.
Yeah.
His physical prowess and his acrobatic skills were second to none.
He'd
taken himself to the utmost limit on every single level that he had been.
I mean,
he was superhuman without being superhuman.
Without having those abilities. I mean, the idea with Doc is that he's, you know, his father, once he's born, his father sets him on this program of self-improvement.
Yeah.
With all, and again, with all the great, you know, geniuses of the world, which, you know, we think about the way Batman's origin has been kind of re-engineered over the years. You know, it's now popular theory that Bruce Wayne went around the world as a, you know, teenager, 20-odd-year-old, and spent time with all these different people. So, again, the elements are all sort of seeping through.
Is there anything else you want to say about old Doc?
Not really, other than that he's forgotten.
Yeah.
I mean, the rights are currently Street & Smith then, I guess, was absorbed by Condé Nast Publications, which is a huge publishing house. The character, as the Shadow, has been reinterpreted by James Patterson along with other writers. The Shadow is, in my opinion, terrible.
The reboot.
The reboot is terrible. Yeah. The Doc Savage novels, the first one, which concerns his great grandson, I think, or maybe even great great grandson, I thought had some merit, but they kind of ruined it with the second one. I don't know. Do they? Can you update these, or are they a product of their time?
No, I think they're a product of their time, and I think if we ever do get to another Shadow or another Doc Savage movie, they need to set them in the proper era. They shouldn't update them.
Yeah, they it's part of their of their appeal. Even down to the kind of visual, you know, the visual notation. I mean, if you took to take a modern-ish comics character, the Rocketeer by the great Dave Stevens, you know, even if Dave Stevens had drawn him, he wouldn't have been as appealing in contemporary time.
No, agreed, absolutely agreed. So that leads us on to, there was another character called the Avenger.
Richard Benson.
Yes, which, again, Paul Ernst created.
Paul Ernst, yeah, again, it was a house name, Kenneth Robeson. I think it was advertised by the creator of Doc Savage, which it probably was by the editors, I think, came up with him. But it was a writer called Paul Ernst. I mean, he lasted far, there was far less Avenger stories.
Yeah.
But again, they reprinted them in the 70s, and actually the reprints were so popular that Ron Goulart, the science fiction writer, was engaged to write a number of new books in the same style, which is not obvious when you actually look at the run of books. But it's interesting how those characters all of a sudden had a life, you know.
Yeah.
And
what made the Avenger unique? Yes, he was a crime fighter, and he was slightly more violent than the others that had come before him in terms of how he dealt with the criminals. But the unique thing about him was, after a terrible accident, his face is not only massively disfigured, his flesh is
it's malleable, isn't it? It's like
malleable.
Clay.
That's it's like clay. Yeah. So he can shape his face into looking like anyone he chooses
for a
period of time, which is how he obviously gets inside the gangs that he's trying to infiltrate and bring down, and you know, deal with corrupt politicians.
Yeah. I mean, he always seems to be like an amalgam of Doc Savage and the Shadow. I mean, but the difference is with the Avenger, he had a pretty violent origin, really, where he lost his family on the plane. Yeah. So you can understand his violent reaction to criminals.
Yeah.
He had a team of experts like Doc had.
Yeah.
Including
gadget, he was very gadget driven as well, the Avenger.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's true. And he had a number of different characters who assisted him, you know, including maybe a couple of the first black positive characters from that era as well.
Yeah.
Which is kind of interesting. But not as popular, certainly nowhere near, I can't remember the number of stories, but nowhere near as many as The Shadow or Doc Savage.
No, but again, his influence, I think, extends beyond his popularity, if that makes sense. So, yeah. I mean, The Punisher from Marvel Comics, the origin basically... And the way that he becomes almost psychotic in the way that he deals with criminal element, it's there. You can see that correlation between the type of anti-hero vigilante that the Punisher was and the way that the Avenger stories were structured. It's there. Yes. You can see, it's a template that is just so obvious.
Absolutely. Yeah. And the visual notation in the reprints, again, the cover model is Steve Holland. So, you know, the image that you kind of associate him with the grey face and the grey uniform. I think didn't he have a couple of weapons called Mike and Ike? One was a gun. One was a knife.
Yes.
But,
which is the classic Joe
Joe Kubert.
That's the one, Joe Kubert, the cover that he did for the Avenger comic with DC.
That's right,
He's leaping out there, playing with the knife in his teeth and the gun in his hand.
Yeah, yeah. And we should say, actually, the other three issues of that short series were drawn by Kirby, which is some terrific sort of period art by Jack Kirby. Ah,
superb.
Again, difficult to revive. I mean, they tried in the late 80s, which I just thought was absolutely terrible, to be honest. Maybe, and as we said, maybe they're a product of their time and maybe they belong in that era.
I know we haven't talked about.
Go on.
The Phantom.
Yeah, Phantom's interesting because he is, in theory, the first costumed hero, isn't he?
Yes. I think we need to spend a few minutes maybe talking about him now.
I mean, the interesting thing about the Phantom is that he's popular everywhere but America.
Yes.
And I think that's something to do with, it's a societal thing. That, you know, Americans admire Bruce Wayne. He's a billionaire. They admire Tony Stark. He's a rich guy.
Yeah. Yeah,
even Doc Savage was a wealthy bloke. The rest of the world admires the Phantom because he protects the oppressed.
Yes.
I think it's really interesting. You know, it says a lot about, you know, about the world, really.
Yeah, I think it does. I think it speaks to the American psyche as well. And the American psyche in terms of the way that it's anything is achievable if you just keep trying.
Yeah.
You try hard. It's really positive in so many ways, and there are people that have done so brilliantly starting with nothing in America.
Yes, yeah.
But it's almost like there is that belief that people can become anything they want to be.
Yeah, which I'm sure is why Doc was popular. I'm sure that's why Doc was popular. He was a self-made in every sense. I mean, you know, he had tons of advantages. And it doesn't quite work. Just as Batman doesn't really work in the real world, you know. But
no,
there's something there that this guy's a self-made man. He's not, you know, he's not man from Mars. He's not landed from Mars or whatever. Yeah. You know, he's a self-made man. All the other guys, they're all experts in their own field, but they've all studied or been in the army. They're not.
Yeah.
They've not just been handed stuff. None of them.
No.
None of them start. I mean, Doc got his wealth in the first adventure, didn't he? The Man of Bronze, when they discovered the Mayan gold mines.
Yeah.
So whilst he was, you know, he was probably privileged, he wasn't ridiculously wealthy, and his philanthropism came from, and then, I don't
acquired
know,
acquired wealth.
It's acquired, yeah, and every time he acquires wealth through his adventures, he always, I mean, in Brand of the Werewolf, they discover this old conquistador treasure in, which, have you ever read Brand of the Werewolf?
No, I must check it out.
It's a great book, Brand of the Werewolf. You'd love it, man. You have to get a copy of Brand of the Werewolf.
I will do. Brand of the Werewolf.
It's a trip, but there's no werewolf in it. That almost makes it better, to be honest. Because I remember the first time, I thought, when's he going to fight this werewolf? Further and further. Well, it's a terrific story. But in that, they find this treasure.
Yeah.
And he says no. And it's set in Canada. And Pat Savage is in it for the first time, which is good as well. And he says, no, what we're going to do with the treasure, this treasure belongs to the indigenous people. We're going to set up a hospital trust and a hospital fund for this part of Canada and stuff. So I think there's something there, really.
Yeah. So I think there is that And going back to that American Psyche thing, so the downside of that is they don't like losers. They don't
That's
like
true.
Losing.
That's a very interesting point. Yeah.
And I think the Phantom, as you said, because he was very much about, you know, the rich and powerful can be callous and corrupt and hurt the weak and
the ones
that are perceived as being
there's something
losers.
A little bit dodgy about the great white man protecting the black tribes of Taganda or whatever. Yeah. I can't remember what it's called, or the island of Kilauea or where he lives.
Yeah.
So there's a little bit about that. But I mean, the other thing that was fascinating about that, have you ever been to Australia?
No, it's one of the...
The Phantom in Australia.
Yeah, that, I know. That.
It's been published since 1941 or something.
Yeah.
It's every month. And in a really cheap format that allows anybody to... You know, they're cheap. One of the best things about being in New Zealand Oz is every 2 weeks, I think it's every 2 weeks, it's not even every month, you go into the news agents, there's a new Phantom.
Yeah.
Oh, new Phantom, great, you know.
Fantastic.
I just used, and they were rubbish, you know, the quality were rubbish, a bit like the pulp. So I just left them in the hostels for other people, and then people would leave them in, you know, ahead of me. So, but they love him, man. They just love him. Yeah. Identifying with him, you know, you see him in adverts. They have a Phantom convention, I think, in Sydney every year.
Is it funny how certain heroes or archetypes become embedded in the psyche of a whole nation?
Yes, yeah.
In a way that other countries look and think, well, it's interesting, but
I mean, why? You know, why you look at that, why isn't Sexton Blake embedded in the British psyche? I think one of those collections, it's called The Great Villains. It's on Amazon. It's Rebellion Books, I think. And there's like five stories in it.
Yeah.
But you can find loads of them on your Kindle for like 99p, you know.
Oh, I'm going to have to check that. I'm going to have to check them out. And of course, so we'll do that. We'll do a second part to this. And we'll talk about the Sword and Sandal, as they were originally known. And within that, you've also got the scientific fantasy crossovers like the John Carter Mars series.
Yeah,
well, so you've got all that
you've got that sort of like almost like romantic science fiction, isn't it?
Yeah.
Which is very different from what, you know, what's around now.
Yeah. But I don't think we could close this episode without mentioning at least one archetypal lady pulp hero. And I didn't know this because I picked up a comic series a decade ago. Called Domino Lady.
Domino Lady, yes.
And
I actually have a collection. I just sold it.
Yeah. And it was, it's very risque. It's very revealing in many ways. And she's not above using her female charms.
I need to have a chat with it at the end of all. Do you want to just do this Domino Lady thing?
Yeah, because. So. We need to talk about, I think, you know, we've talked about the men and we're going to come back and talk about the Sword and Sandal, which was mostly men, but there's a couple of interesting female characters in that. But there was this lady called Domino Lady. And she was, again, a masked crime fighter.
Yeah, yeah.
But moving in slightly different circles.
Yeah, she had the really practical crime fighting outfit of a flimsy dress with a long slip the side of the skirt.
Yeah.
It's ideal, ideal.
Occasionally she wore a hat, though.
Did she?
Yeah. Yes.
What, only the hat?
So they were quite, even back then when she first came out, which was 1936.
Okay. So same era.
Yeah, so the original Domino Lady, the covers were quite racy for their time, and the stories were kind of, again, like, almost like spicy tales rather than
the true
gritty detective
I'll go see your weird stories or something.
She tended to move in socialite circles and then come across a crime and then change into the Domino Lady.
Absolutely.
But she was the first female masked
vigilante
superhero model.
Yeah, superhero vigilante. Yeah, interesting. I mean, I would imagine that even though she's female, most of the readership was probably male. It was the same crowd who was reading, you know, spicy tales or whatever. But I mean, it's an interesting take on it. I think didn't a few years back, Jim Steranko, he collected all the stories in a volume, and I think he added an origin story for her.
Yeah. Well, in the original stories, again, it was her father was killed by a criminal.
Okay, okay.
And that's when she decided that she was going to become this vigilante to bring to justice.
You can see how these tropes were being created, you know, just knocked off one by one, and then they've been reproduced in the decades since.
Yeah. And I think the thing that was unique about her, apart from the raciness of the actual story, was she wasn't above using seduction,
okay,
and psychological manipulation. So she would use her charms to manipulate others to do her dirty work.
Yeah.
So it's quite clever how they weave that in, even in this kind of spicy tale type set of stories.
Yeah, and interesting, because it would have been so easy just to make her a female version of the Shadow.
Yeah,
you know, with the firearms to dispense justice. But it's interesting they took a different angle. I'd love to know how much of the readership was split between male and female, even though she was a female character.
Again, we could do an episode on this on its own right, and that's the way that the covers were designed on all these magazines and all the weird tales, and as you say, the Shadow magazine, and how they came about. There were quite a lot of female artists doing the artwork on the covers, which is something I found really interesting. Okay. So again, that's something else we could possibly look at in a future episode. So we will definitely do the Sword and Sandal / Sorcery and the science fiction heroes, Flash Gordon, for example, Buck Rogers, John Carter.
Yeah.
I think we'll do that in another episode.
Yes.
Going back to our archetypal hero model here, is there anything else you want to add before we bring it to a close?
Not really, other than I think, you know, what we've discussed is the creation of those two disparate hero types, the dark, you know, the vigilante.
Yeah.
And
The
clean cut superhuman. Yeah, there we go. They were created from a number of influences, but what you can say is that they've persisted ever since.
Yeah. Yeah,
almost relentlessly persisted ever since.
And the thing that modern readers or modern listeners that are listening to this and they've no idea who the Shadow, Doc Savage, the Avenger, Domino Lady were, is there would be no Marvel comics and no DC comics without those characters coming first.
There would be no summer movie program.
This is true as well. But given the quality of some of the recent releases, that might not have been a bad thing.
Well,
but
that's why, if you think that, that's why you should go back to the originals.
Correct.
And read the originals and see, you know, and take a look at the wellspring where all this came from. Yeah. Because, you know, A, they're entertaining, and B, it's fascinating to see how what we might perceive as being original, etc., 100 years later, actually it's isn't. Not. Some guys had this taped many, many decades ago.
Oh, I enjoyed that. So we'll
thanks, Darren.
We'll set a date for the follow up to this, because I think we definitely have to come back and do a part two. It's too big a subject.
Yes,
and really enjoyed that. I was going to say something, and it's gone completely out of my. Oh, I know what it was. And of course, there'll be a forum post for people to come and comment
on their
memories. I will also put. I think we'll put links up to some of the places where they can go and find some of these collections. And some of the articles that people have done. Because I think the more that people know about the history of where things came from, the more they will appreciate what we have today.
Absolutely. Thanks, Darren. Appreciate it.
Cheers,
mate. See you soon, buddy. See ya.
Thanks a lot.
And so, once again, we leave our modern heroes, as they ponder on the mysteries of comicdom, and plan their next sojourn into our mystical realm of the heroes of yesteryear. If you found this episode of interest, don't forget to check out the three previous Adventures in Comics episodes, which were on Atlas Comics at 50, The Real Life Mystery of the Human Fly, and What It Was That Sent Our Heroes on the Path of Comic Adventures in the First Place. You can also share your anecdotes and opinions on the community post, which you will find by going to darreninform.com thinkworks.com/community and scrolling down to the ThinkWorks recent doorway. Until next time, this is Lady Domino, on behalf of Darren and Chris, wishing you all a thrilling adventure of your own.